From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Burak, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Recently, two local elderly care facilities were placed on probation for failure to provide proper care to their patients. Today, we'll talk with Stuart Grable, ombudsman for the Pima Council on Aging, about how to choose the right care facility for your loved one. To sign up for certain government programs, senior citizens must be able to provide proof of citizenship by providing a birth certificate. But what happens if you don't have one? This morning, Christopher Conover reports on one woman who is having that problem. And with higher gas prices and pricey airfare, will Tucson summer tourism season be strong? We'll have the forecast. Plus, Bill Mortimer has a feature story on the Desert Living Courtyard at Tohono O'odham Park. Those stories and more coming up, but first. Two assisted living homes in Tucson have been placed on probation after state investigators found they neglected elderly residents. Health officials found that staff at Carestone at River Center failed to react to a resident's seriously deteriorating medical condition, and Casa Linda Home Care was placed on probation after investigators found no certified caregivers on site. Stuart Grable is ombudsman for the Pima Council on Aging. He joins us now in our studios to talk about these recent violations and how to choose a proper care facility for a loved one. Stuart, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, first, if we can talk a little bit about the problems that have occurred with the two Tucson nursing homes. What have been the major issues with these nursing homes?
Well, from our perspective, it looks like people who were in facilities were in facilities that did not have the level of care that they required. It seems like, from the information we have, that people required greater supervision, more direct care than was available in the facility that they were placed in. And there's a couple of different reasons for that, none of them really justifiable, but one is people age in place. That is, they move into a facility which is perfect for them at that time, and then they age in place. And while they're there, their condition worsens. And since that place has become their home, they don't want to leave. They don't want to go to a higher level of care, which will involve more money and which would involve hopefully better staffing patterns. So that's one of the issues that we see. And again, the pressures for this sometimes come monetarily. Sometimes people place folks in a facility that they can afford, even if that facility doesn't have the level of care that's required. So that's part of the problem. The other is a general societal thing where we don't pay our teachers enough, we don't pay the people who care for our elderly enough, and we don't give them enough impetus and enough training and enough skills to do the job as well as it should be done.
Will this be an eye-opening experience in that maybe they'll start to reevaluate the lack of funding and really start to prioritize?
Boy, I hope so. Yesterday I was speaking to one of our state representatives, Ted Downing, and he was talking about the possibility of trying to start a senior caucus in the state legislature to take a look at issues affecting older persons, because our population is skyrocketing in terms of elderly, and we're going to need to develop a plan that will adequately take care of folks. And what we have now is a system that looks to provide services on the cheap, on the least expensive way. We underfund our adult protective services. We underfund the Department of Health Services, which licenses the facilities and is responsible for for the reports and monitoring the quality of care that they provide. And when we underfund these things, we get surprised and shocked when things go bad, instead of recognizing that that's the natural outcome of not paying people enough, of not funding the programs adequately, of forcing people whose income isn't high enough to go into facilities that aren't capable of caring for them.
What should people look for when they go and they view nursing care facilities? What should they be looking for?
Well, a typical call that comes into me is a daughter or a son or a grandson saying, my mom needs to go to a nursing home. And my first question back to them is, well, what does mom say about that? Because we're dealing with not children, with adults. Even though they may have lost some of their faculties, they are responsible for their lives. And here's where seniors sometimes don't help. They make their loved ones promise them that you'll never put me in a nursing home. Well, nursing homes may be the most appropriate place for that person, or assisted living facilities, which are a lower level of care. And most of the problems that we were just talking about occurred in assisted living facilities. But promise me you won't send me there. Well, the reality is that may be the most appropriate. We have lots of stories of people who had made promises that they wouldn't go there and then did just fine. They were amazed at how much better their quality of life could be in a facility that was designed to help them. So we need to watch our promises. We need to, again, match that level of care with what the doctor says the person needs. And unfortunately, finances play a part in that. And you need to figure out what's appropriate for that person and also recognize that it might change. The family also does a lot better if there are family members who can visit, who can go to the facility. And if you're checking out a facility, there's a number of, again, steps that you can take. First, online, if you're looking at a skilled nursing facility, Medicare at www.medicare.gov, has a website that lists, that has a program called Nursing Home Compare, which you can compare nursing homes based on the quality reports that have been submitted. For assisted living facilities, you can check with the Arizona Department of Health Services. They're the entity that supervises and licenses adult care facilities. So those are some of the things that you can do. There are also lists of questions. We also advise people to visit the place, but not necessarily just during visiting hours. Visit during a mealtime, or in the evening, or on the weekend, because weekend staff is often different than weekday staff, and you need to see how people are treated at all different kinds of times of the day. So all of those things are key. And use all your senses when you visit the place. Use your sense of smell. What is it that you hear?
And how often are these facilities monitored?
At least annually, they're supposed to be monitored. It's a secret day that the Department of Health Services goes there. They're not supposed to. The facility isn't notified in advance when they're coming. Although, if you haven't had one in 11 months, chances are in the next month or two you're going to be reviewed. The Department of Health Services has actually gotten better in terms of covering facilities. But again, it's not as tight as it could be, and we need better resources in dealing with that.
And the Department of Health Services is too understaffed. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Also the other arm that looked into this would be Adult Protective Services, which is responsible for reviewing allegations of neglect, abuse, and exploitation. And they are underfunded. As a matter of fact, there is in the governor's budget funding to increase this, but right now, we're hopeful that will that will come through. But for right now, they are understaffed. They find it very difficult to recruit and train staff and keep them because the salary levels are so low.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Stuart.
Well, thank you.
For more information on how to choose a proper care facility, log on to pcoa.org or call the Pima Council on Aging at 790-7262. Stay tuned to Arizona Spotlight when we continue the story of a local woman who is having difficulty enrolling in certain government programs because she can't provide proof of citizenship. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. On July 1st, the federal government will begin requiring proof of citizenship for certain services like Medicaid. That's already the case for a number of states. But as Christopher Conover reports, the new requirements may leave some of Arizona's oldest citizens without the help they need.
No doubt about it. When you meet Ivy Anderson, you know she's very much alive.
It's not my fault, and it's not my parents' fault, hey.
But officially, that's harder to prove, because when she was born in rural Minnesota in 1926, no birth certificate was issued.
My mother never went to a doctor. She never had a doc. She never went to a hospital. I think that she did have a midwife when we children were born. And my father was working long, long hours. And there was just, you know, when it came for birth certificates, there was nothing there. I mean, this was construction crew and just moving and moving and with construction, and that's what we did. So there was no need for it until then. Finally, I wanted to get a job when my first husband and I broke up, and I wanted it for a better job. I was doing babysitting. And I wanted a better job, and I couldn't do it without a birth certificate.
While that may seem trivial to some, Stuart Grable with the Pima Council on Aging says changes in both federal and state law make that lack of a birth certificate a very real problem when senior citizens try and get into certain government programs like Medicaid.
The assistance for supplemental payments to help make the payments for Medicare, the co-payments for Medicare, long-term care, nursing home services under the Medicaid program in Arizona, that's Altex, are requiring not that you be a citizen, but that you be able to produce certain documents. And the problem is that there are lots of seniors who were born 70, 80, 90, or even 100 years ago when those documents were not required.
Ivy says for many years, she didn't have a need for a birth certificate.
I never had to worry about a birth certificate, no, because I did get a Social Security when I went to work in the paper mill in International Falls. It was called M&O, Minnesota and Ontario Paper Company. I couldn't work there until I had a Social Security number. So I went to the Falls Journal, where they handled the Social Security numbers, and I got a Social Security number. That was the first time. And I don't know what they asked me on that form. That's what I wrote to them, and I tried to get some information, but I have none. I haven't heard anything from them yet.
In the 1950s, Ivy did need that birth certificate, and that's when she began contacting the state of Minnesota and others, building up quite a stack of letters and paperwork, more than 6 inches tall, with postmarks dating back more than 4 decades. She says once she got close.
When I got information from Minneapolis, they told me I would have to go to the county seat or the county that I was born in and go there to the Hall of Records. So we went there once, but I didn't have everything I needed. And they were just moving, and they had no way of doing anything. They were moving from one building or one office to another, upstairs or downstairs, and so I couldn't do anything then.
The new federal law does allow paperwork in addition to passports and birth certificates to be used to prove citizenship. Those new papers include unofficial documents like medical records and affidavits. But the affidavits are only supposed to be used in rare circumstances and must be signed by two people, one of whom is not related to the person seeking the government services. And those signing the legal document must provide proof of their own citizenship. The Pima Council on Aging's Stuart Grable says the affidavit requirements are problematic.
You have a witness who was an adult or at least a certain age when that person was born. So we've literally had a case of a 105-year-old woman, which would require a 115-year-old witness to prove that that she was a citizen.
Now advocates for the elderly are searching for another solution to what they see as a growing problem.
We are looking for the development of some sort of either appeals process or some sort of mechanism that someone in authority can make a determination that someone like Ivy is eligible, even though she does not have a birth certificate because she was moving, and in her time, that just wasn't done. It wasn't required.
In the meantime, Ivy's getting ready to head to Minnesota, hoping some old-fashioned FaceTime with government officials will help.
I've been trying everything I could do to get this, you know, taken care of, and so far no luck. Just nothing.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
Up next on Arizona Spotlight, a report on Tucson's summer tourism season and how tourism officials are confident it will be strong. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. There's no doubt summer has arrived in Tucson, and even though temperatures have already surpassed 100 degrees and gas prices are at or near $3 a gallon, tourism officials expect the summer visitor season to be strong.
Well, this summer we expect the leisure rates to be as strong as ever. This summer we don't have as many conventions as we had last year, but as we all know, the conventions tend to be cyclical. Well, they'll be in 1 year, they may not be in the following, but will be back the next year.
Kimberly Schmidt is with the Tucson Convention and Visitors Bureau. She says because summer is not Tucson's main tourism season, they're targeting the local population and the regional traveler, luring those from other parts of the state to the Old Pueblo.
A lot of us know that we are a little bit cooler here than are some of our neighbors a little further north. So yes, we do get a lot of drive-in and day trip, you know, traffic. So I would say yes, most of it is regional at this point, and there are locals just getting out to enjoy what amenities there are here in Tucson at a very reasonable rate, and then folks that are trying to escape a little bit more heat that they may have in their areas.
And so the Tucson Convention and Visitors Bureau has once again launched the Tucson Super Savers website to get the word out about all the activities Tucson has to offer during the summer months.
It's a really excellent opportunity for people to have a really nice, perhaps a resort experience at a really reasonable rate. So what we do is we have supersavers.com, which is part of our website at visittucson.org, or you can go to supersavers.com. And there is a listing of accommodations, hotel, and resort partners there. And you can view them to see what's in your, you know, what's in your plans, what kind of experience you would like to have. And in some cases, some of their rates are cut by 50%.
The Tucson Super Savers program is promoted within a 150-mile radius of Tucson. And when you book through the website, you get a special Tucson passport, Kimberly Schmitz.
You get one Tucson passport per two guests that register. And the passport is actually a $400 value. It's sold for $15 in our visitor center here, but you get one for free when you sign up through Super Savers. And what it basically is it's a booklet that looks like a passport, so you can go to different attractions, different shopping areas, and it offers over $400 in savings on attractions in the form of two-for-one or savings for meals. and discounts in certain shopping areas in town.
The Westin La Paloma, located on the northeast side of Tucson, is known mostly for its rich green golf course and upscale spa facilities. They're one of a number of resorts in southern Arizona hoping for strong occupancy rates this summer.
With the rising gas prices, we certainly expect to have a strong drive-in market from local Tucson and also Phoenix. That is a big part of our summer business is the drive-in traffic. So we expect that to be really strong this summer.
Bill Petralla is general manager. He says the resort has geared their summer marketing strategy toward the local and regional population, and they're looking forward to a robust summer, expecting occupancy rates in the upper 70s, mostly because of the special summer packages they're offering.
We have unlimited golf, starting from $159, where you can come and stay and golf for two players as often as you can in that one and a half days that you're with us. So it's a great package for those avid golfers.
Typically, Westin La Paloma does most of their business from January to May, but are expecting a busy and profitable summer.
Great summer. We're feeling great about it, and we know our projections are up already based on the advanced bookings, and we're really optimistic about the summer.
To learn more about the special summer offers around Tucson this summer, log on to TucsonSuperSavers.com. Up next on Arizona Spotlight, Bill Mortimer has a feature story on the Desert Living Courtyard at Tohonatchil Park. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Tohonatchil Park is where nature, art, and culture connect. KUAZ's Bill Mortimer recently visited the park to look at some of the features that make it so unique.
Good morning, I'm Bill Mortimer, here enjoying the quiet charm of Tohonatchil Park. Today I've been invited to see the new Desert Living Courtyard. It's right next to what used to be the Haunted Bookshop and occupies the area that once was the parking lot. With me is Jeffrey Trent. Jeff, you are the professional garden designer that was brought in for this project. You told me that Joe Falls, who is the director of public programs and has been with the park for many years, was the one who came up with the idea, but of course several people brought it to fruition. The plan was to have a demonstration garden that would showcase a number of different ways of dealing with residential landscape and a low water use format and working with plants of the Sonoran Desert. So taking what they had in mind, you came back with some ideas.
Essentially 10 different garden styles that we could work with and create these vignettes, enough that they were complete and could give a flavor of a whole garden. The plan also uses architectural elements to help define out the spaces so that the gardens flow together, but at the same time they're separate.
Jeff, give us an overview of the gardens you've created here, and then we'll take a little walk and talk about some of them.
A garden we're calling the Mexican Heritage Garden that draws on barrio traditions, a garden that draws on traditions from Islamic gardens in the Middle East, a container garden, a wildlife garden, and a xeriscape demonstration garden, a garden that shows dry shade plants, a winter-summer garden, so plants that are blooming or showy in the hardest seasons of the year to grow things in Tucson. There's a garden that shows utilitarian facets of landscaping and vegetable gardening. A garden is designed for more family outdoor living and entertaining, not so much for a plantsman. And a meditation garden that draws on traditions from Zen gardens, actually, in Japan.
Let's step over here to our first garden. This is the barrio garden.
I wouldn't call this so much a pure barrio garden. It's more of an abstraction of a barrio garden, taking sort of flavor of that environment and trying to interpret it in a modern way for other kinds of residences. But the crucial elements I really saw were enclosure, use of medicinal plants or plants that are particularly treasured like roses, the existence of a shrine. In this case, we use Saint Fiacre, who is one of the patron saints of gardening. We've used metal fence, ocotillo fence against painted walls. A number of years ago, designed a kind of arbor, which we've used here, which is an abstraction of the Tohonotam Ramadas with the mesquite posts.
Now this has an arbor with a rose attached, so yeah. It's going to climb.
Right. There's a trellis behind it, and I'm actually using, having had the trellis made out of Carrizo, or Arundodonax. It's a giant reed that was imported from Spain for construction material here. So again, it's not a native plant, but it has a really long heritage of use in barrio cultures here and was brought by the Spaniards. And actually, I swiped it from a wash in downtown Tucson. It wasn't grown in anybody's yard.
The Moorish garden is a departure, I would say, from our usual desert plantings. What is the background in this particular design?
The Moorish garden would imply really the importation of gardening ideas into Spain from Islamic culture through Morocco. But the garden form that you see here is actually much older than Islam. It's divided into a four-square pattern called the Shahar Bagh, and that developed really in Persia thousands of years ago and was a combination of ideas that came from Egypt and Assyria. So it's a very, very ancient garden style, and it was one that was adopted by Islamic culture when they conquered Persia and was spread all through the Islamic world from India all the way to Spain and then brought to the New World with the Spanish conquest.
And the kind of plants that we'll see here?
Well, in a traditional true Moorish garden, plants that you would have seen would have included almond, pomegranate, cypress, sycamore trees perhaps. We're working with a lower water use motif here, so we're actually using an alligator bark juniper instead of cypress. We did use dwarf pomegranates. They're not native, but long tradition of use here. We're trying a native peach, and then I've tried to capture a sense of the green and coolness with paint, blue terracotta in the fountain and in the pavement, dark blue paint on the walls, and then lushness in the plantings. They're low water use, or where they're higher water use plants, they're basically on north-facing walls and going to get a lot of shade, so they're not going to require the water they would in full sun.
Our next stop is a meditation garden, which is totally enclosed.
Yeah, and let me shut the gate, because this is one that's a garden that's designed to be viewed and appreciated in quiet. It's a very small space. It's smallest of all of the gardens that we've got in here. And I would say that it draws on ideas that come from Zen gardens, but it is not a Zen garden. It is not a Japanese garden. What we've done here is try and represent the earth and natural environment in use of large rocks, to use plantings that will grow in and make this a much richer space down the road. These grasses we used instead of bamboo. They'll be vertical growing, quite tall, to get a sense of motion in here. Fine textured trees like the Palo Blanco and Brazil wood over here. The whole space is designed to be a place where you could sit and even in a tiny area appreciate the calm and appreciate the plantings and just sort of clear your head.
The Desert Living Courtyard and featuring 10 different gardens. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Bill Mortimer.
For more information about the Desert Living Courtyard at Tohono O'odham Park, log on to tohonoodhampark.org. Bloom Night at Tohono O'odham Park is drawing near. It's the annual free event for the community when the park stays open from 6 p.m. until midnight for viewing of the spectacular night-blooming cirrus collection. The date depends on Mother Nature, so check the daily hotline at 742-6455, extension 915. And now here's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
This weekend on stage, the Live Theater Workshop presents On Golden Pond, and the Red Barn Theater has the musical Sweet Charity both closing their runs, while the Tucson Theater Ensemble begins a run of Neil Simon's Plaza Suite. It's tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 and a Sunday matinee at 2. The second week of the Somerset Concert Series continues at the Westward Look Resort this Sunday night as the Tucson Jazz Society presents the Larry Redhouse Trio. That's a look at what's going on this weekend. This is Mark McLemore for Arizona Spotlight.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Burak.